Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to the Lanterne Rouge Cycling Podcast for the recap of the Tour de France 2023, including the Stage 21 quick recap, the Champs-Élysées stage yesterday. We're going to get into all the big discussion points, you know, which teams were successful or not successful during this Tour de France, including the non-UAE, non-Jumbo teams. Who was the breakout performer, the Tour de France Derek G, like Rodriguez perhaps, and also discussing for maybe future thinking, what do Jumbo need to do in the future, if anything? Do UAE need to change something up, bring different riders to the Tour, or are they fine as well? And it's, does Pogacar need to change anything as well as rating the Tour de France? But yeah, it's before the dust has settled too much, we wanted to do this while it's fresh in the minds. But yesterday, from Saint-Quentin-en-Yvelines to Paris-Champs-Élysées, 114Ks, the procession stage, lots of photos taken, and then there was threats of rain, Benji. I think in the end, they did take the GC times on the second last lap?
Correct. They did that because obviously maybe Jumbo asked them to do so because they might have the plan to drop back towards the finish line and have their bit of a ceremonial moment with the entire team behind the peloton. Maybe that's the reasoning. Wouldn't have mattered because he was so far ahead in GC anyway. But we did see a pretty interesting stage, as in lots of attacks and so forth. Pogacar very active in those attacks. Really fun to see. Nathan van Hooydonk not showing the real ciclismo, not riding with Pogacar, which in GC stage, you'd understand. In this stage for fun, I would have enjoyed seeing him ride. Alpecin did doing the lead out in the end, because it came back together, because there were loads of teams doing the work for Alpecin, like Jayco, like Intermarché, and it came to a sprint. And I feel like Philipsen kind of launched a bit late because other riders came over him already, and it led to a different guy winning.
Yeah, but so Christoph, he was going to, at the turn, the right-hand turn, I thought Philipsen's going to win this easy because he was fifth wheel. Rickard was doing the lead out at 700, 800, and then it was Moritz, Christoph, and Christoph wasn't sprinting. He was leading out. And so I think Philipsen wins this sprint perhaps if Christoph doesn't go the wrong way around Moritz. Christoph went to the barrier side as Moritz was pulling off barrier side and flicking. It was very similar to when Laporte decided to move ahead of Mercu last year as Mercu peeled off into Laporte's path. And that basically cost Philipsen and Van der Poel, I would say, 75 free meters. And so Van der Poel starts his lead out at 475. Philipsen doesn't want to launch at 250. Groenewegen does, though. And, you know, I understand it. He wants to basically box Philipsen in, which he does. And he does put Philipsen under pressure a little bit. The curious thing was Groenewegen could have safely gone to the barriers. He had jumped ahead of Philipsen and he had could just go in front of Van der Poel, who's slowing down, and go to the barriers. He opens the door back up to Philipsen, which you're not obliged to do. But yeah, tracking him was Pedersen, and then tracking him was Mayus, and he just had the perfect timing and run in and comes out of the Pedersen wheel and nails Philipsen on the line and beats him with the throw. So huge win at the last gasp. Shuts up the naysayers. Benji, you said Bennett should have been taken. like me.
Wait. You're pointing it at me now.
No.
You would have won on Col de l'Or, Sam Bennett. I feel it. It's a great win.
It's a great win.
And it makes me wonder what else is possible, you know? Like, next year there's rumors of Sam Wells for Tubora. Then we know that's a sprinter that hasn't been able to show himself too much because DSM doesn't know what way to go around roundabouts. But next to that, I was also like, Sam Walsford went into the attack yesterday in moves and breakaways. And that was probably the one stage where I wouldn't have done that. As in, you want DSM to go in attacks, but you don't want him to do it with their sprinter because that's a secondary option at the finish line. But anyway, that stage is over. I'm curious what Mayus can show in the future. I'm curious what loads of sprinters can show in the future, because we've got a merry-go-round next year with all the transfers and so forth. But Philipsen had a pretty bloody strong tour regardless of losing the stage, huh?
Yeah, he did. And, you know, it's a bike throw photo finish away from 5 Tour de France stage wins, which should have equaled Kittel and Cavendish. But yeah, Mayus, first World Tour win as a sprinter, being on Champs-Élysées. Has that ever happened before, that a sprinter has won on Champs-Élysées and that's their first World Tour level victory? It seems improbable when I think of Van Aert, Bennett, Groenewegen, who else, Cavendish. Like, it's incredible. And it makes the tour for Bora. It bookends it very, very nicely for them as well. So I thought it was actually, I still, to the last gasp, could not believe Intermarché weren't putting Binnie in the attack and Turnison in the attack. And in the, I still couldn't believe they're riding for a sprint. But, you know, what's the definition of insanity?
Doing the same thing all over again.
And expecting a different result. But Groenewegen and Jacobs, a little bit different. I really did think he had a genuine chance to win. He is that fast but you know, he didn't have the last minute. Yep. So the best sprint trainer, best sprinters, clearly Jasper Philipsen. But before we get into the jerseys, of which he obviously won the green jersey, we wanted to say a big thank you to all of you who listened throughout the Tour de France. We broke all our listenership records, whether that's the Netflix effect, whether the Tour de France was that good, whether we're just that good. I'll let you be the judge.
I think it's that.
It must be that, right? But yeah, thanks everyone for listening. We read all the comments, wherever they are, on Twitter, on the YouTube videos, on the Spotify. And thanks also for your support during the tour through the donation link. That was also incredible support. So I wanted to do a big thank you for that, because that means we'll be going to the Vuelta in Barcelona, getting Benji, get him a little sun hat. It's going to be hot in August.
Sun hat.
Yeah, we're going to get you. Have to get you some hat and sun of screeners, bro.
Don't you dare get me a bucket hat. Don't you dare.
I got the Highland cow hat from the Worlds on order. I hope it gets here before Worlds. It looks so sick. But yeah, Benji and Luke will be coming again for the Vuelta, and then up to Andorra for the first week at least, and we'll be doing watch alongs like the Tour de France, and that's thanks to your support. So thanks very much for all that. Anything you'd like to say, Benji?
I want to regurgitate what you just said, basically, that without people listening to us, without people watching our content, this wouldn't be possible. And getting the support, getting the feedback, the nicest thing about doing this is being able to see your opinion as well in the comments and maybe change our mind as a consequence, or learn something new from you guys. It doesn't mean us having this podcast doesn't mean that everything we say is the law. So it's always fun when other people give their takes as well on the comments and so forth. Patrick with the side eye.
Dude, I was getting cooked after stage 14. The YouTube comments in the pod were cooking me.
Yeah, mate, you were the biggest Pogacar fanboy, according to the comments.
Well, no, and then other people were like, Patrick's been badly humbled. He's got to throw the spreadsheet away. Spreadsheet, I think, was right in the end. But anyway, no. It's great. I reread all the comments. It's great that people engage with it. And of course, you know, we're wrong all the time just as much as we're right. And that's the fun of it, having our opinions and seeing your all opinions. It's great. And we won't stop doing it. So anyway, enough of that. On to the KOM. First of all, Giulio Ciccone, a full team effort from Trek, Little Trek. He wins it ahead of Felix Gull and Vingegaard, who both didn't really go for it. I'm really happy that a rider won it, as I've said before, who wasn't going for it. Who wasn't a GC rider, who just won it accidentally. I still think Col de la Loze, it makes no sense to me that was double points. I think that that had the potential to really ruin it. But yeah, great from Little Trek and Ciccone, and they win a stage and KOM, and it's better than a top 10. It's better than ninth on GC. Like, don't you reckon? You get to go on the podium, man. In Paris, and you have the sick bike and everything. I if I was a sponsor, I'd rather Ciccone than a ninth result.
I think so as well. It's also, KOM's a pretty legendary thing, you know? It's like, it's not, the white jersey is not as memorable as the polka dot jersey, for example. And the polka dot jersey is really that panache jersey in the Tour de France, come on. And I would like to add that not just Ciccone has to be thanked for that Col de la Loze being a non-decider in the KOM. Gull kind of did that for them. So
yeah, by
Gull kind of made sure by being ahead, and some other GC ride, breakaway riders as well, made sure by being ahead that a Vingegaard would not take full points there. So that's also a major effect here. And I like that it was a real battle this time. Like, towards the end, it became clear that Ciccone was likely to take it because Gull didn't have the punch at the top of climbs, you know? So it kind of was, can Ciccone stay ahead of GC riders by the last mountain stage? And Trek pulled that off perfectly. And I also like how much they meme about it on, for example, on Twitter, on social media. There's like this cartoon of a white dog with like red polka dots on it in Italy. And Ciccone has been memed as that dog for like the last week of the Tour de France. So I enjoy that kind of humor, the team supporting that stuff. And yeah, I can't complain, Ciccone. The thing is, like, the thing with Ciccone is, he's had such an evolution, eh? As in, first stage wins in Grand Tours was his first bracket of things to do. Then towards GC, at the start of this year, he was a good GC rider in one-week races. Whether he could do it in a Grand Tour, that was questionable, but he was supposed to ride the Giro, wasn't able to do that because he got ill, if I recall correctly, yeah, or something. Then ended up doing the Tour de France, and I was kind of worried he'd end up doing GC, but the team quickly made sure that it was obvious that Skelmoser was the GC rider for potential top 10, but Skelmoser then fell through, and I like how the team adapted to that. Pedersen and Skelmoser on the stages that didn't fit them were perfect domestiques for Ciccone, and they deserve credit for that.
Yeah, great team performance, and every KOM sprint, they were trying something, they planned it, the last stage, you know, they got in every breakaway, and that's why I think a lot of teams were slow to react to the fact that in the third and second week, if you wanted to get in the breakaway, just tag on to, just sit on Ciccone, and then the break is not going to go without them. But yeah, great work from them. Their new sponsor, I think, will be quite happy because, yeah, the Tour de France will promote very hard whoever is in the KOM jersey because Leclerc, another rival supermarket, coincidentally, sponsors the jersey. So they promote the shit out of it. Green jersey. Jasper Philipsen wins handily with a 119-point lead. Actually narrower than I expected, that lead, over Pedersen. It was, to be honest, if you win four stages and come second in another two stages and fourth in another two or three stages.
Yeah.
The green jersey was a foregone conclusion when he was so dominant. It was a bit of a shame. I do like when intermediate sprints matter, but to me, not a single intermediate sprint in this entire Tour de France was of any importance or interest.
Exactly, and it also quickly became a lost battle because if Philipsen wins a lot in week one, then it becomes clear that he's going to win the race when it comes to the point jersey. We saw the same with Wout van Aert early on last year, where we knew if, based on first week, that he was so far ahead already, that he had so many points that it would be difficult for anyone to really compete with Wout van Aert for the green jersey. So the only difference there was that Wout was still going in breakaways, was still taking green jersey points and so forth. And like you say, the green jersey points, the gates, the intermediate sprints had no value at all in the second half of this race, probably in the first half either, to be honest. But I will say Alpecin circled themselves around Philipsen and it paid off. Van der Poel did lead outs on the sprint stages. He didn't have that much individual success, but he was able to support the team when it mattered. And that led to probably at least one of the Philipsen victories probably wouldn't have happened if it wasn't Van der Poel leading him out. So that's a very valuable rider there. Their behavior, we can't neglect it. It wasn't the nicest Tour de France when it comes to behavior from the team. And that goes with Philipsen's behavior in sprints, Philipsen's behavior on the road, Van der Poel's behavior in the lead out and so forth, and just the general feeling that I get when it comes to Alpecin as a consequence of that is not that they're the most sportsmanlike team on the road, but when it comes to their performance, they kicked it out of the park.
This completes their evolution as the new Quickstep, taking four stage wins with the sprint, a dominant sprinter in green jersey. I think Van der Poel was sick during this tour. He was coughing at the end. Like, he couldn't stop coughing in the final interview. So whether this was preparation for Worlds and he was tapering, you know, for Worlds just nicely, mm-hmm, I'd question that. That's in like 2 weeks. And yeah, to me, he looks sick. So, and you know, he's their big star. So it takes good management to be like, Jasper every day. We're going Jasper every day, like Limoges. You could tell Van der Poel wanted to go for that stage, I think. And he got told on the bus that morning that Philipsen was their best chance. So anyway,
honestly,
when
it comes to the management, the Rothof brothers, I feel like they kind of look like good cop, bad cop between the two of them. As in, one of them seems to be the guy that makes the rough decisions, while the other one is like the emotional character they can rest upon, is how I view it from the TDF Unchained series of last year. But I will say that I kind of like it online. If you had to grasp an idea of who these two people are based on the reactions on the TDF Unchained series, then they would actually be portrayed as some kind of psychopaths according to social media. They were actually getting roasted for how they acted in that to the Franz Unchained episode.
Really?
But I like that, because a management that is able to make the right decisions at the right time is what leads you to victory in these kind of races. And I feel like their management is really on point. They were in front of it a few years ago when it comes to the UCI points and so forth, and their benefit of the first few spots in Pro Conti, for example. Like, their entire evolution as a team, they've been making the right decisions, I feel like.
Yeah, generally speaking. GC, some of the... They have let two talented GC riders go in Vine 100%. And Talbot, but they probably have doubled down on what they think they're good at, which is fit sprinters. Like, they brought Groves in, fit sprinter, and that's what sort of is their wheelhouse. But yeah, no one's perfect, but with the budget they have, they outperform that, and yeah, outstanding, really, the way the team is going. Few minor things aside. We'll skip white jersey. It's not really, it's the last year Pogacar wins it.
That's
so
sad.
It should be Rodriguez or Ayuso next year. Is Remco still eligible? How old? I don't know.
I think he is. It's like the end of an era, the fact that Pogacar can't win the white jersey anymore. I think
four
he's got
row.
Four, which is a record. So I don't know. I'm looking forward to see who he has it next year, but it's going to be between the riders you mentioned, Ayuso, Remco, and so forth, and can't wait for that battle. But we've mentioned the KOM points. We mentioned the points. And we mentioned the white jersey. Let's take a look at the teams for a second, because there's been a lot of teams in this race. A few that might as well have not started, because I didn't see a few of them very much in this race. But there's also teams that knocked it completely out of the park. And I think one of the first teams I want to mention to you is, for example, Bahrain. I feel like Mikel Landa rode as if he's washed, but the rest of the team delivered. Moritz stage win, Wout Poels stage win, Bilbao stage win, and then 16 GC from Bilbao. Obviously,
top five, 10 seconds off fifth.
Benefited from Hindley's crash, but that doesn't matter. That's what happens in cycling, eh? So the game's the game.
And he was super strong in the break on Col de la Loz. Like, he got in that break. Hindley didn't get in that break. Rodriguez didn't get in that break. And so that's where Simon Felipe, Yates, and Bilbao and Godu, they all took time. So,
yeah,
I think Bahrain had an outstanding Tour de France. They just keep winning. They know how to win break stages. They put the right riders in. They put multiple riders in. Those riders make the right moves at the right times. They have good race feel. They get in the right, they target the right stages with those profile of riders. I will say, well, Poel's performance is one of the most surprising things, like in the Tour, it's kind of gone under the radar how strong he was. The fact that he did from the breakaway on Betex, he did that climb, I think, like faster than all the GC riders, but five or six of them. So, and then it was kind of not, I don't know, we didn't really see him again. but yeah, they picked it the right, he and Bilbao and Moritz, outstanding. Haig was good helping Bilbao and the GC and Lowe's. So, and right too, you know, probably not the Tour he would have hoped for. And they lost Bauhaus. Like, they would have got even more points, but he got sick or something.
He actually had solid sprints. I think he bought him the stage here and there.
Top five,
so
in like four of them.
It was really nice to see that Bauhaus was able to step up to Tour de France level sprints after being stuck in the what can I call it? The BTEC sprint category.
Yeah.
The Tour of Croatia, the Hungary, those kind of races. He would be doing the sprints in those races, and to see him step up to this level and being able to top five sprints shows that he's on that level. And I also feel like they did well in keeping Bauhaus up there in sprints, like you said, like the Mohoric one in that stage where Jakobsen fell. That was a really good stage for Bahrain when it comes to positioning. But Bahrain aside, what is another team for you that really, really knocked it out of the park?
Cofidis, obviously, you know, the 15-year drought broken by two stage wins from two different riders, plus Guillaume Martin wins the Zubeldia Award. He gets top 10 in the GC without being on TV for 3 weeks with you know, doing it on his own. I'm not mocking him. I'm saying good on him. No, this guy doesn't ask for any team support. He doesn't demand which riders come to the tour with him, and he gets in breaks and does his own thing, and he comes top 10. Good on him.
I saw him three times, I think, this week. Two times where he was bridging to a breakaway that already established, last minute, and bridged towards it, and it worked. And the third time was at the back of the group, doing a Louis Mankies, trying to hold on for his dear life. And that's what you need to do, eh? Those are the things you need to do. You need to make sure you try and go in breakaways that might make it to the finish line. And he did that. And on the other end, you need to try and make sure you can hold on whenever you're not in the breakaway. So it was really impressive by then. And when it comes to the Cofidis drought, are you surprised that Lafay was kind of invisible after stage two?
I reckon he's getting pissed every night.
Possible. Well, did you hear what Walshide had to say?
Yeah, that's from Walshide. Said he's like the old school cyclist, like a rock star. So, and I'm not even. Listen, if you're a French rider, you win in the Grand Départ stages, break Cofidis wind drought. Why can't you get drunk every night? I don't think they even care. Also, on Guillaume Martin, he helped a lot in that Izaguirre stage win on stage 12. He was marking moves. He was excellent. So their teamwork was good. Obviously, Lecoq, I would love to him to win a stage, but you know, he finished third in the points as well, the intermediate sprint, not the green jersey competition. Zangler, maybe I hope for a little bit more talented young French rider from the Alsace region on Cofidis, but you can't have everything. And for their budget, you know, they got to be happy. Asia 2R also, they just keep winning stages as well. And Gull could have, you know, top 10 GC. You know, it's not O'Connor after third in the Dauphiné. Again, they probably would have hoped for maybe top five, but a stage win in the Queen stage, Gull, top 10, good teamwork. Yeah. I don't actually know who else was in their team. I got to be honest.
In Agisair, Ben O'Connor, Gull, Nassen was in there. He was the guy riding for a bit when they were trying to get Gull into the top 10 on that random stage where everybody was roasting them for trying to get Gull from 13th to eventually 16th at the end of the stage, but they were trying to get him into the top 10. But in the end, it worked out. But that stage, the tactic doesn't get saved by the result of this race, of course. I am super impressed by Gull. We'll talk a bit more about him in one of the next topics, but there's just a lot of teams that overperformed, like Lidl, you would argue as well. Go ahead.
Did you know Benoit Cosnefroy was at this race?
I saw him once, and that's
what are they paying this guy? They just
actually extended a lot of money.
Him. He'll be on heavy seven figures.
Yeah, he's definitely above seven figures. A French the rider guy, on a French team.
Did he get
team.
In a break?
he tried getting in the break 2 days ago on the second last stage to counter Ciccone, which was super weird.
Man. Anyway. Right, at least he seems like a nice guy.
That's what you want to hear as a cyclist, eh? You don't perform, but at least you seem like a nice guy.
But it's just like, you perform like that, and then you get a two-year extension on millions of euros. It's like, fucking hell.
Insane.
Anyway, he does win races occasionally. APP also, you know, I like APP, the PP brothers, but he also had a tough Tour de France, but he was good earlier in the year. So anyway, Julien Jardy, GOAT DS, best DS in cycling.
I want to see a tattoo with Felix Gall on it.
He is.
On
he's
his
getting
back
it.
Next time. Is he? That's crazy.
He said he's getting it.
Lidl, Bora, also teams that are probably going to be proud of their performance. Hindley had bad luck, so Bora can't be overly sad about the fact that he still ended up seventh after that crash on his hip and so forth. Wore the yellow jersey for a day, won that stage. I think they won another stage with Jordi Meus on the Champs-Élysées, so that's a pretty big win. Lidl with their polka dot jersey and so forth, winning a stage with Pedersen as well. Next to that, I think they can be happy as well. But there's also some teams that were absolute wrecks in this race. If Moscon was a team, nobody would have known he was in this race. But the same kind of counts for Arkea. Mozzato got top 10s in sprints, top 12s in sprints. And Sean Poussin was completely invisible. And for the money that he gets, he probably should be being relatively visible.
Wow, that was good.
What, sorry?
Buggy was pretty good.
he was in breaks, but uncompetitive.
But he's always,
you know,
isolated.
So, yeah.
It's so hard in those breaks when you're on your own.
And for the rest, like, well, RKO just, I don't know, they might as well have not started this race.
Do they need Lopez or Quintana? I'm telling you.
DSM?
Astana, I don't want to... Cav did look pretty good, and they were getting better. It's tough when you're all around a sprinter, he crashes out. It's like, can you really roast them? Yes, you would like ideally the other riders to perform, but they were around one rider. But yeah, DSM, Benji, I feel like, yeah, they had a shocker.
They had a true shocker, and I think it's also a team car problem, because like issues like not going around the roundabout the right way in a sprint lead out, you can make that mistake once as a rider, but if it happens every sprint, then I'd argue it's probably because the riders weren't aware that they had to go on one side of the roundabout instead of the other. And other situations as well as that, Bardet just wasn't on the level, and he was probably sick in the first 2 weeks, but then eventually also crashed out on stage 14, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
And
but he's always sick.
Yeah. Except for the, well, okay, he also got sick on the Giro last year, so at that point I can bin. But for Mark and Dinham, I reckon were pretty good surrounding
Mark
him.
Mark was good, yeah. They were good for young guys, I thought.
But they can't get results at this point, you know? So it's kind of like they were good, but they weren't able to show anything for it. And they've got the least UCI points of any team in this race. So didn't gain much from that either. I've got Arkea and DSM at the bottom in the mud, in the bin. At this race, but there's also some teams that you probably want to go on a roundabout Groupama, don't you?
Oh no, I'm all spent up. I've already said it all. It's all the same I said before. Like, it's just what happened that we expected. You know, Gaudu, you know, he came ninth, but
as expected.
Yeah, like I thought he would come seventh to tenth. That's fine, whatever. Gino got in some breaks, super strong legs. Didn't make right decisions at the right time, so didn't win. But, you know, it was a nice send-off on stage 20. Like, still was good that he was up there, but, you know, Madawaz and Kung either... Like, Kung just doesn't perform at the power he has in Grand Tours. I don't know whether what the issue is, but, yeah, they, you know, you don't bring Demar and half the stages suit him, then this is the result. So, anyway... Like, it's not a criticism either of Lars Vandenberg. I thought he was actually quite good in a couple of breakaways. But yeah, Pache and Lagac and Genius weren't good. Yeah. And you should have taken Demar. But EF also, you know, a lot of their riders, they did have Carapaz crash out on stage one, who would have been probably gone for a breakaway stage win and might have won one, probably would have. That always hurts. Same with Movistar with Mas. But yeah, a lot of the team just didn't. Also, Chavez DNF, Shaw DNF on crashes, I think, in stage 14. So that hurts too. But Court was nowhere. Uran was not really that good. And Bettiol was relevant in a couple of stages at the back end of the third week.
Yeah. And I would say that there's just so many teams like that that had their rider crash out in a similar way when it comes to Carapaz. So Movistar lost Mas, for example. Then Antermarché lost Mankies, who was also in the top 10. Then Quickstep lost Jakobsen, but then again, he wasn't showing it really anyway. Astana,
Cavendish,
you mentioned that. Yeah, it probably got them the stage when it was green.
He won too.
Exactly. So I don't know. I still don't feel like Quickstep saved their Tour de France, because I think they should be getting at least two stage wins with the team that they have on the big roster. But hey, they got what they have, and that's kind of how I view the team so far. The rest of the teams are kind of like the middle pack, I'd say. Didn't overperform, didn't underperform. Obviously, Jumbo, Alpecin, and UAE are at the top. Eh? That's the obvious ones. That's why didn't go in-depth in these. Right now, we'll go a bit more in-depth towards the end of this podcast in those teams, but do you reckon you had a Derek Gidas Tour de France? Like, that kind of rider that broke out in the Giro, someone like that in the Tour?
I thought it was going to be Nalens, again, another Israel rider, but then he did get tired and he wasn't able to keep going in week three, because Nalens... On that stage where he got caught by the stage Bilbao one, was it stage 10? Nalens was just, couldn't feel the chains. So Nalens was really, really good. They extended him. That was probably from before the Tour. And then there's also, you know, Gull. It's one thing to do it in the Tour of Alps. It's one thing to do it to the Swiss. And it's like Schelmoser kind of didn't corroborate his performance from Tour de Suisse. He was very good and a great team effort, Ciccone, but is sort of what happened, but Goal kicked on and got even better from Tour de Suisse. So I think Goal is probably the breakout, even though there were already signs. Johannessen was good, but Lefay also. Yeah, Lefay is a difficult one because already I thought he was very, very good. Consistency, I question. The Valscheid comments, whilst they are funny, I think if you look at his consistency and how he can be so good, so good. He's literally with Pog and Jonas on the Côte de Piquet, no one else, and attacks them. And listen, maybe he goes to Montreal and Quebec and wins there. Maybe he goes to and wins two podiums Italian Classics, yeah. And he was tired during the TDF. I don't know. Maybe he kicks on, but the Valscheid comments in with the consistency is like, are you kind of like causing for? I don't know. So I'd go with Gull almost.
It sounds like Lafay is the kind of rider that if you switch him towards a team that takes everything super seriously, that forces him to follow his training program and so forth, then you either get a rider that doesn't enjoy cycling, or you get a rider that gets the step up that, for example, Laporte had when he moved to Jumbo-Visma.
Yeah, he might hate it, and he might only perform in a relaxed environment. Not everyone can do the Jumbo-Visma living on Teide every year. It's not for everybody. But I'd be interested. I hope he stays at Cofidis and they can get some cash to keep him. French Tour de France stage winner. I think it'd be great if he stayed there, and I'd love to see him at the Ardennes again next year in their colours. Gull. Yeah, who's your breakouts? Those guys?
Those names were definitely on the list. Carlos Rodriguez is definitely worth mentioning after the GC step-up he made. Yes, he ended up fifth after the crash on stage 20, but the thing with Rodriguez as well is he actually had like two Grand Tours where he stepped up and performed. And at those Grand Tours, he crashed heavily in week 3 and dropped in GC spots in the last week, which is really sad, actually. Last year with the Vuelta, dropped to 7th after being in the top 5 and so forth, and this year we've got the Tour de France, and there's loads of rumors when it comes to their transfers. Even Lafay, for example, there's rumors about him. There's rumors about Rodriguez, and the thing with him is that I heard something about there being a pre-contract or something, but no written contract yet with Movistar. So, and I also heard some internal issues with the transfers and so forth at Ineos, so it's all very curious of where things are going to go, whether they're going to re-sign Carlos Rodriguez, whether he goes to Movistar. I reckon if you're Ineos, I would kind of like keeping Carlos Rodriguez after this Tour de France.
What else are you going to do?
I don't know, man. Hope Pidcock actually steps up.
I think, they got to do their best to keep him. He's 22 years old and might have finished fourth in the Tour de France. He does crash a lot. He has good handling, but there's like the yin and yang to that is he seems to take a lot of risks or crash a lot. He did say he had a broken front wheel, though, in that crash, but there's been a lot of other crashes too, including the Vuelta last year. I would say the Yates brothers, they're the 30-year-old breakouts because they actually, they both had outstanding Tour de France. Yates finishing on the podium for the first, I should probably read out the top 10, actually. if I can get there. In terms of GC, Vingegaard winning by 7:30 ahead of Pogacar. Adam Yates, third on 10:56. It's a big gap, but still his first ever Grand Tour podium, and it's on the Tour de France at UAE after moving from Ineos, and his brother Simon Yates in fourth. So they both had very, very good Tours de France. That's GC, Benji. Vingegaard kind of had the... It's not really much. He just was so solid. Like everything went to plan. There were a few concerning moments on Juplan when Pogacar attacked. It's like, is he going to lose a lot of time here? But he came back. I think Jumbo took a risk sending Roglic to the Giro and not to the Tour de France. But in the end, it paid off, and now they have both. So what do you think they do? Do they need Roglic at the Tour?
Well, it was a gamble, eh? Choosing to divide the power there, but it was probably also people management involved in that decision. And then being split up between the Grand Tours bothers the question, can they actually win both Grand Tours? Can Roglic beat the likes of Evenepoel, the likes of Thomas? He ends up winning that race. Then we come here and we're like, oh, can Vingegaard do it without Roglic? And towards the Tour de France and the preparation races with Pogacar's injury and so forth, the sign was to the fact that Vingegaard would actually have a chance of winning the Tour de France. Like, they were relatively 50-50 in the betting odds. In some countries, Pogacar was ahead. In some countries, Vingegaard was ahead, how I viewed it at least. And I think if we take a look at how Jumbo did it throughout this Tour de France, Vingegaard was very solid. He had wobbles left and right, but Pogacar did as well. And the wobbles that Pogacar had were of a much more severe magnitude than the ones of Vingegaard. I would also say that if Pogacar didn't have his wobbles on Mardi Blanc and on the Col de la Loa stage, he still wouldn't have won this Tour de France because the time trial difference was so significant. And taking a look at how this third week wobble of Pogacar could have existed, I want to maybe go over it for a second. So how we see this stage was in week one that Pogacar was very explosive, right? We see it on multiple stages. They kind of played with the pretender role that Yates is a GC rider, a potential threat to Vingegaard. I don't think Jumbo super believed that they should be afraid of Adam Yates throughout this race. Maybe in week one they were a bit wary, but I wouldn't say they were overly scared either that Vingegaard would be dropped by Adam Yates by the third week, for example. Mate,
I fear
you thought Adam Yates was the second coming of Jesus Christ, so... But if we then go further, we see that Jumbo-Visma applies a strategy, how I viewed it at least, where they try and make stages more difficult. Every big stage, they try and make difficult from the start, whether it's pacing, whether it's satellite rider up front to try and get the race rolling early on so that it doesn't really stop. That for me looked like they were trying to reduce the attack that Pogacar has on the last climb, because they realized on Pitadom, for example, that when the gap is created, then there's separation, and then Pogacar might be climbing at the same time as Vingegaard. So if they can reduce the initial separation that Pogacar can make by making the stages harder, then they might be able to benefit. And on the Jouplan stage, I felt like a lot of people were saying, oh, this is a win for Pogacar that Vingegaard didn't drop him here after an entire day of racing, but I felt like it was the opposite. I felt like it was a point towards Vingegaard at that day because he was able to come back after Jumbo successfully reduced the attack of Pogacar. And I saw that as a light point for week three. And I'm not going to say that when it comes to Col de la Loa, for example, Pogacar falls completely through the ice. He loses 5 minutes. I think Jumbo has an effect on that by the fatigue that they build up in the stages beforehand. I think they had a bit of help with the likes of Ineos and so forth pacing on that stage itself to make it harder as well. But I also did not expect Pogacar to fall through the ice that early on Col de la Loa. So it's like, is there something on Pogacar's end, on UAE's end, in the preparation, in the nutrition, and stuff like that, that makes it that on every major Queen stage of the last 3 years, he falls through the ice. He did it on Ventoux, 40 seconds lost in the span of 1 to 2 kilometers, roughly. And then we go a year later, we see on Granon, similar fashion, falls through the ice towards the end of a hard stage after a relatively rough few stages. And this time around, rough few weeks in front of a very big Queen stage, and then he falls through the ice again. What do you reckon, man? I don't know.
Yeah, I saw Jouplan was, as you said, kind of the turning point where, okay, he stalled. He stalled at the end of that attack. Vingegaard came back to him. Of course, everyone was saying, oh, the motos, like the moto blocked Pogacar. And, you know, I don't think it ended up changing the Tour de France result. Maybe it did, that motorbike blocking Pogacar.
7 minutes difference of blocking.
But, yeah, that seemed to be a turning point to me. And then on Le Betex, I was pretty sure it was done, actually. When he let Yates' wheel go, huge weakness. Huge sign of weakness because it made no logical sense. And then Vingegaard basically outsprints him in the finish and stops, looks at him, and lets Pogacar roll across the line first. I was like, he's going to get cooked on lows because that's about five times harder than the Betex, which is actually was a sneaky hard stage. And so, yeah, I don't know, like UAE come out of rest days pretty, I don't know, pretty bad. like stage 10 after first rest day. Pogacar said that was like the hardest stage of the tour so far after that stage. And that was a break. That was the one Bilbao won. The stage de Foix last year in stage 16 on Piguet, he looked like shit. And then the TT, not good. And not his best TT. And then Lowe's, terrible, obviously.
It is noticeable that it's 1 or 2 days after the rest day every time, eh? Because the three queen stages where he drops is 2 stages after each rest day. This might be complete conspiracy theory, but the pattern is there. So it's probably useful to take a look at it if you're UAE to see if there's something with, I think you mentioned it at some point, maybe nutrition on a rest day, for example. Can that lead to this?
I mean, like the real hot takes is like the backflip in the pool on the rest day is why he lost 6 minutes. people literally said that. I think Schleck or someone really said it. It's like, come on. Like, you can pick anything you like that. I don't know. It's obvious he struggles on the super hard stages. And if you have a crisis, that's the thing. If you have a crisis there, because like Vingegaard didn't really have a crisis when he got dropped. On Puy de Dôme, Vingegaard was still good. He loses 8 seconds. On Cartere, he was still good. He attacked on Tourmalet 60 kilometers out, attacked him again on Cordere, flicked himself.
Yeah, but...
And, you know, so Vingegaard doesn't really have these huge problem moments.
Yeah. He doesn't have those major wobbles, and I think the major wobble that he had was Cordere, where I think the mental side of things was the one that hit more than the physical side, because at that point, he just had Marie Blanc. He thought he was top-notch, much better than Pogacar. Pogacar wasn't on the level that he needed to be. And then on Tourmalet, he can't drop him. And on Col today, he's starting to slowly realize it's starting to sip through his brain. Like, fuck, this guy's much better than yesterday. And that he drops him there. And then I think the larger gap was created because Vingegaard mentally was like, fuck, 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 fuck. I think that went through his head at that moment. And I think that's something that's underrated on Col today. While on Puy de Dôme, for example, he might have been able to switch that button a tiny bit and already start thinking, okay, I need to make sure I can hold on. And I think that's the difference between those two stages. But like you mentioned Roglic, like Vingegaard just won the Tour de France. They don't need Roglic next to Vingegaard to win the Tour de France. They've proven it. Simple there and then. Would I like to see them both in a Grand Tour against the Yuzo, Pogacar and Almeida? Fuck yes. I want everybody to come to the Tour de France next year. Every single soul needs to be in that race. Eddy Merckx can unretire on Lotto Soudal, and I'd love to see it. But I think they don't necessarily need it. Would it have made the Tour de France easier to win for Jumbo-Visma? Probably a tiny bit.
No, I don't think so.
Really?
It's almost easy. It's almost easier looking after one leader. Mm-hmm. You're the sprint stages, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And this didn't play any role, and this is a discussion point of what UAE might need to change. Like, thank God, fortunately, but typically you do. There was no sprint crash this year.
Yeah.
Usually, in one of these stages, from 15k's to go or 20k's to go to 3k's to go, there's a crash because that's just the reality of life. And there wasn't this year really a major pile up. Which is unusual, and maybe it was because they had such a hard Basque Country start. I think that was actually good. But UAE were in terrible position. They even gave up trying, and Vingegaard was always at the front. In the end, it was a waste of energy for Jumbo. They got no benefit for it because there was no issues, and actually UAE got to conserve. But if you're looking, I don't think you can just say, well, it wasn't a problem this year, so... We don't need to change the team next year. That's been a problem for Roglic. Vingegaard, I think, holds the wheel better. But for UAE, they got to get in a rouleur. We've been saying it, for 2 years?
Yeah.
They got to get in some better rouleurs. Because Bjerg, Trentin is probably leaving as well. Mm-hmm. Bjerg and Langen, they, first of all, cannot do that job in the final 30Ks. And they cannot manage a break formation to save their life.
Exactly. And they need that rider not solely for the positioning, like you mentioned, sprints, but also for that breakaway formation to try and close down bigger groups that try and bridge to the group ahead. Because we mentioned this before, an ideal breakaway formation control phase for a GC team, if you want to control the breakaway, is smaller group goes ahead, and then you try and prevent the groups that try and bridge to the breakaway to actually get separation from the peloton by having a rider smoothly close down the gap towards that bridging group. That's kind of the process you see there. And if a Yumbo jumps, you try and neutralize that in a similar fashion or try and jump with him, depending on what you desire from that stage. And we don't see that when it comes to UAE. They don't necessarily do that. We saw Soler, for example, on stage 20, while he had to do small flea closing bridging groups, what he did was jumping to the group and then realizing he did it wrong and then dropping back and then starting to pace that group. That was messy. And that's not the stuff you want to see. That was on a climb, though, so it's understandable that Soler does that and not the likes of Langen. But I will say that the rumors of Niels Paulet going to this team are very good rumors, and they need a rider like that in this team 100%. He would be able to pull this off. And I wouldn't even mind if they had two Niels Paulets in their squad, because one can't do the break formation phase alone. And when you look at Jumbo Visma, they've got multiple riders that can do that. Van Baal is a good ruler. Van Hooydonk is a good ruler. Laporte is a good ruler. Van Aert could fucking do it if he needed to. So they have like so many riders that can do this role, while UAE kind of has no one that is able to do it properly. But is it also not, is it just a rider issue?
Or no, do you reckon it's a tactical issue?
Because you remember what they said on that, what sounded like a meme radio communication thingy, where they said, jump with the tigers or something and then follow the crocodiles, something like that. That was about the breakaway formation. It was in the UAE video they had on YouTube, how they explained that. So their plan was simple. They jump with Jumbo Visma's and they follow if riders in the top 10 and so forth try to go in breakaways.
Why?
Like,
why
I don't
do you
know.
Care if David Gaudu gets in the break?
I don't care either, but on the third part, I think you can have issues with the first two, but the major issue for me is that there's not a third part that says we need to smoothly control bridging groups to the breakaway to make sure the break isn't large. Because there were multiple stages where they ended up chasing a 20-plus, 25-plus man group that could have been an 8-man group.
Because they spend 20 minutes chasing 3-man groups. Look at the Vosges stage. Soler was closing down groups of 3. And it was like Ciccone, Schelmoser, and like an EF.
Yeah.
And it's like, dude, it's 3 guys. They're going to kill themselves going for KOM points. To me, UAE came out with the plan for stage 20 that they were never going to even allow a breakaway to form.
Yeah.
On the foot, I was like, that's impossible. You cannot ride the whole stage like that. Now, in the end, they did bring back, well, Kelderman had to help, but they were strong enough. And that's because their climbing squad is really, really good. Like, you look at Micah, Groschart, the Yates, Soler, excellent. Excellent climbing squad. And Yates was, you know, to have the guy come in third as a domestique, he must be climbing pretty well. So on that mountainous stage, they could do it. But to not be able to control a break on 140K Grand Colombier Unipuerto, when you really want to win the stage, yes, it's not good. But otherwise, you know, there's not too many, apart from Paulet, there's not too many, like, Kung's not on the market. The Jumbo guys, like, they should have gone for Laporte, like, stolen
but,
him.
Yeah. Kung was on the market. Søren Krogh Andersen was on the market. They have the money to sign those riders, but they fell last year. So
they didn't prioritize those signings. They don't match their compound score thing. So they just signed Sivakov. Like, what? Sivakov is a nice rider, don't get me wrong. How does he improve their chance of winning the tour?
I think it adds another climber to the system that won't necessarily move the needle. I think maybe he performs better than a Groschartner, maybe ups them by like 1% in the mountain train, but it won't necessarily help them win the Tour de France, because at that point it's all about Pogacar to be able to be better than Vingegaard. Because I think the teams are strong. Both teams are the strongest teams at the start line, roughly. So we're looking at these against each other, and Vingegaard didn't win this Tour de France because Jumbo Visma was the better team over UAE Team Emirates. They probably were.
Oh, they were way better.
Yeah, but it wasn't the reason that Vingegaard won. Vingegaard won because he straight up 1v1 beat Pogacar over 3 weeks with support of their teams.
Vingegaard, I don't think so. Look how nervous he is in the bunch. I think if he doesn't have these super rulers creating a bubble around him, who knows what could happen. I think if he's on Bora, I don't see it. I really think like having Van Baarle, Van Hooijdonk and Laporte keeping him safe in the pocket, it makes it, you don't really see it because it's in a different stage to the mountain stage, but I think it makes a big difference. Conserving energy, keeping him safe, keeping him calm. But yeah, I think I'm hoping next year that Ineos and a Quickstep can join the party. I don't want it just to be UAE versus Jumbo. Remco has to go to the Tour 2024, whatever team he's on, whether if that's Ineos, if to believe the rumors. I know
Israel is also mentioned.
Oh, come on, man. I know Davey B was back at the Tour coincidentally when they won their two stages. So I'd love to see them get back in the fight, as well as Quickstep or another team. Maybe Bora, maybe Urtebrooks. Who knows? These young guys progress so quickly. But yeah, is there anything else from? I guess we'll see Vingegaard at the Tour with at the Vuelta with Roglic. That'll be a really, if we want to see Remco against the Jumbo duo, that'll be it's pretty appetizing with Ayuso. I think Ayuso will also do the Tour next year. With Pogacar or without, I think with Pogacar. But yeah, anything else, Benji, from the Tour that you'd like to highlight?
I think I do want to talk on that for a little bit. Jonas Vingegaard going to the Vuelta is a pretty major thing because Pogacar hasn't had a year where he rode two Grand Tours yet. Vingegaard making the step after winning two Tour de France's is for me a really good step in my eyes. I love when a rider wins that Grand Tour, realizes there's a bigger picture at Jumbo-Visma that they could win all three Grand Tours and then steps up to do that again in the third Grand Tour in the year. As a co-leader with Roglic, yes, there is a chance out there that they absolutely dominate GC and it becomes a boring race into the second week. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's a certainty because Vingegaard's doing a second Grand Tour in a year. We don't know if that's going to affect him or not. Kuss might be there in his third Grand Tour in a year, which GC Kuss, do it, please. Thank you. Roglic is coming back. He's not the Roglic he was 3 years ago, but he is still fucking good. And there is still competition throughout while there's no Pogacar, which I found really, on one end, it's really sad, but on the other end, I would understand if they do it to try and figure out what happened in the third week of the Tour de France. If that is the reason,
no,
to try
no,
and build towards next
that's
year.
That's not the reason.
What is the reason? Because like,
points and keeping Ayuso happy. They want Pogacar to do the Canadian classics, all the Italian classics, and get loads
fuck
of
Canadian
points.
Canadian classics. Fuck Lombardia.
A lot of points.
Like, I love Canadians, and I love that they love having a race there.
It was actually a great race last year, both of them.
Yeah, but nobody remembers the Canadian classics a week after they existed.
I remember Pogacar torching Van Aert in Montreal and Benoit. Even though I abused Benoit at the start of this pod, it was a great win in Quebec. And then he went missing for another year. Maybe we'll see him back in Quebec. I think Pog will do Plouay for points.
I don't care.
I bet you. And that's why they're doing it, to win the UCI ranking. And also because, yeah, Don upset the apple cart with Ayuso, who's been promised Vuelta leadership since the start of this year. And that's what Machin is. He says a lot and he's true to it. He says that they have a lot of guys with a lot of ambition, you know, and they yes. try to keep them all happy. And they've so far given a lot of guys their own opportunities.
But I think what he said is also not ideal either, what he said after the Tour de France when Vingegaard announced that he went going to the Vuelta. Machin said that they won't adapt their plans according to their competition. I think that's a public statement. I think behind the scenes they relatively often change their plans according to what Jumbo-Visma does and so forth, in the same way that Jumbo-Visma adapts their plan according to what UAE does
Roglic
every now and
Pog
then.
Avoided each other for 2 years.
Yeah, exactly.
It was so annoying.
But, for example, Vingegaard going to the Vuelta, it was probably already planned. It was already planned since the winter or something. But it's also good that they follow through with it. And when it comes to Pogacar not going to the Vuelta, I think they're reducing their chances of winning the Vuelta with Ayuso.
For sure.
By not having Pogacar next to him.
For sure. I mean, yeah, Vingegaard might be in his crow race form and then it's not so much of a problem. He might be in his Basque Country form and then you got Roglic.
Yeah. Only's coming.
Exactly. Oscar Only win the Vuelta. And Max Poole. But you have Roglic is doing, this is the first time in 3 years he's doing a proper preparation for the Vuelta? So it's not like he was that bad in the Giro. So he's doing a proper prep for the Vuelta without crashing out of the Tour de France. You know, Vingegaard, now Ayuso is on his own. No, I mean, Jay will be there.
My man, João Almeida, the legend himself.
Oh, true, Almeida will be there.
But what do you reckon?
Would you take Vingegaard and Roglic or Almeida and Ayuso?
Almeida and Ayuso, because it's much more fun.
Yeah, it is much more fun. I'd rather be on that bus watching how they plan that. But yeah, I can't wait for that. But yeah, it's going to be a cracker. And poor old Evenepoel's like, Jesus Christ. Why is it? But to your point on Pogacar, I think the Vuelta is his best Grand Tour. I think it suits him the most. And
I think so as well.
But, you know, when if he does Giro Tour double next year, when's he going to do it? I mean, he's only 25, but...
Yeah, but maybe not this year it fits in that best. A big Tourmalet stage? A big Angliru
stage? It's short. It's 130Ks. Short. True. No mount. There's one warm-up climb before Angliru. It suits him.
Yeah, but...
There's no stage like Lowe's or Grenoble.
True.
And he'd clean up the bonies on all these sprints.
If you're the ASO organizer and you see the last two Tour de France and you see this Tour de France, do you adapt it? Or do you reckon you make it similar to this year? Or do you make it less with an obvious brutal mountain in the Queen stage to see if it gets closer?
I don't know. I have to look at the previous ones in 20. What was in 21?
I don't remember, dude.
21 had that Ventoux stage was 200Ks. Pretty difficult. And then 2020... Col de la Lowe's, that stage, pretty difficult. They have to have one serious mountain stage. They can't just have uni puertos like, So I think you got to have a bit of both. And if Pogacar's got to not, I mean, if you lose 6 minutes, then fuck. Like, it's hard to design a parkour where you can take 6 minutes back.
Yeah.
Like, so, yeah. Anyway, how would you rate this tour?
How would I rate this Tour de France? I find it very difficult. If I take a look at the last Tour de France 2022, I look at that Tour de France and I say, that was a bloody good Tour de France, but in the last few days, it was obvious that Jonas Vingegaard was going to win the Tour de France. There was some wobble in the last week when it comes to Jumbo-Visma, the stage where McNulty really blew it up and was his strongest self ever, and then Pogacar was able to compete there on the good stage, I'm pretty sure that was. That was a big one where I was like, ooh, maybe there's some hope in having an interesting race here. But it never really got closer from there. Otakam was the final nail in the coffin that knocked Pogacar out of the race when it comes to GC. So it was a very good race. And the memorable Granol stage really hits home hard. If I take a look at this year, I feel like loads of stages were really good. But my mind doesn't automatically go to one stage and say, oh, that was a stage like the Granol stage, for example. In my head, it doesn't happen like that. It's not on that level. Even though I had a stage somewhere in the first 2 weeks where I was like, after the stage where I was like, oh, this was pretty fucking great. But it's every GC stage here was great because it kept close. And yes, one rider took time on one stage, then another took time on the next stage and so forth. Like the Tourmalet stage was fucking great with Coulter and so forth, Pogacar winning in the end, striking back from the day before. That's one stage where I look back and say, that's probably one of the better stages of this Tour de France. Real Ciclismo from Jumbo-Visma on the Tourmalet. Real Ciclismo from Pogacar on Col Tourette trying to whoop Vingegaard's ass. And it's hard to rate those tours compared to each other. Last year, I would have said Tour de France was the best one I've seen in my lifetime. Probably recency bias as well. But I'd say this one is probably not far from it, but I might rate it just under.
I think this tour was better. And not just for the GC fight. I felt like every stage, like stage 10 and 12, these medium mountain breakaway stages were unbelievably exciting and dynamic and people attacking. And, you know, the Jon Izagirre stage win, I'll actually remember that. And I thought the Grand Départ was outstanding and so much better than the one last year as well, the way started it. I think, and as you said, I agree with what you're saying. I can see that in like the analytics of my highlight videos, for example. There's no video that's just like, bam, 1 million views. But the general, and for example, like the Col de Juplan stage, in the end, not really a historical stage that I'll go back and watch like a Granon stage. But when you watched it live, because of the narrowness of the GC gap, the tension in that in week two, even though you look at week two, no GC changes in the top two. No real time, much time, just Pogacar and Bonies. But the tension, the feeling that Pogacar was coming back and gaining time and then Vingegaard fighting back on Lebetex, when you watched it live, was crazy. In hindsight, you'd be like, oh, but when I thought it was really, really more stages where they were going at each other. And to be honest, like on Périgueux, I didn't really live. I was like, well, yeah, Pog's going to win the stage probably, but 2 minute gap, what are you going to do? So the closeness of the gap really made it feel exciting live. And then even like the Asgreen stage win instead of a boring sprint, or the Moritz stage was, I thought, really exciting. So I thought it was really good. And that's, you can see that in the analytics, not just on my channel, but on the, like the Tour de France official channel. There seems to be, maybe that is the Netflix effect. Maybe they just upped their game. I think it's probably both. But yeah, I thought it was really, really exciting. And the only stage that I thought was a bit meh was, I can't even remember.
Well, that's usually it, eh?
The stage Amador wanted, stage 11. Amador was the only one that wanted to get in the breakaway, and then everyone helped Philipsen win the stage in a sprint. I thought that was a bit tedious. But anyway, I'd give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Whew. I'd give it a 4.43 out of 5.
Okay, because it's obviously could have been a 5. Say the GC gap was even 30 seconds either way into the Alsace stage, then it would have been carnage on Saturday, but that didn't happen in the end.
If we have to be honest,
that never happens.
If we compare this race to the Giro of this year.
Oh my God.
If I had to score the Giro after having seen the Tour de France, it's about a 2 out of 5. Like, generous. The Roglic GT doesn't save that bloody race.
Generous. Yeah. Oh. Anyway, we hope you all enjoyed the tour. Obviously, still covering the Tour de France Femmes avec Zwift every single stage. So make sure you see our recap later this evening. We've also obviously got World Championships in 2 weeks. It's much earlier this year, then a little bit of a gap, and then the Vuelta a España, which, we, as we've already said, with a bit of a teaser, the start list of that is absolutely stacked so far. So Real Ciclismo is coming. In the Vuelta, best Grand Tour. So yeah, I can't wait. And the season's not over yet just because the tour is over. But if you joined us for the first time, thanks for your support, all your support as always. And to our loyal listeners from years ago, hope you really enjoyed it. We tried our best for the coverage, and here's to another great Tour de France next year. I think we will. I think teams are going to go back to the drawing board, and it's going to be a cracker. But until then, ciao.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.